This is Nora Levin interviewing Dr. Jacques Lipitz, July 12th. So, Dr. Lipitz, would you be good enough to tell us a little about your family, your background, where you were born and grew up?
I was born in Antwerp, Belgium in 1932. My father was born in Kaunas, Kovno, Lithuania. He had come to Belgium after World War II to study at the university in Liège, and he then married my mother, who had been born in Belgium, or came to Belgium before age 1 year old. My mother's family came from somewhere in Russia, and in her family there was a rabbi, Gabriel Halpern, who was known as the grand rabbi of a town, the name of which I don't remember. He may have been the only rabbi, but he was the grand rabbi. My father's family came from Kovno. As I said, there have been scholars in the family. I don't know of any distinguished ones particularly. And my father was in business in Belgium. He was in the business of selling animal hair, which he would import from China. And I grew up in a I had two younger brothers. My father's business was in the house. We lived in a very large house in Antwerp, which is still standing to this day. And sort of interesting, a few years back, my oldest son went to Antwerp by himself after college, and he brought me back a picture of the house, and the house had been converted into office buildings, and would you believe it that the office was occupied by a psychologist?
Which is what
which
you
is
are.
What I am, which is sort of ironic, I guess. I remember early childhood memories include hearing a lot of languages spoken around the house. There was obviously French, which was the language we used, and Flemish, and which is the other language of Belgium. And there was a lot of Yiddish, there was some Hebrew, there was Russian, there was Polish, and there was English. The English came from my mother's side of the family. During World War I, my maternal grandparents took the family to London, where my grandmother, who I'd never met, died during the flu epidemic. And then they came back to Belgium, and my grandfather, who I also never met, and my maternal grandparents I never met, also died. But my mother spoke fluent English with a very pronounced British accent, and to her dying day referred to the faucet as a tap. I think she stopped saying Laurie at one point in the bit of a truck, but she did have a number of Britishisms in her talk. As a young boy, I was taken by my father twice to Lithuania by train to Kovno to meet my grandparents, my paternal grandparents. Who were in the agricultural business, and I met a whole bunch of relatives. I don't remember much about Lithuania, but there's a story which my father tells, which I don't remember happened, but it's very typical. I was there at one time for the high holidays, and of course I didn't speak Lithuanian or Yiddish, I only spoke French. I was, I think, 5 years old at the time. And it was Yom Kippur, and between services, we were apparently walking in the streets, and we passed by a bakery, and I wanted a roll, and I was jabbering away in French to my father, saying, you know, I wanted this piece of bread. My grandparents were very firm, and my father was sort of ashamed to say anything. And finally, my grandfather said, what did the little boy want? I mean, I don't understand what he's saying, but it's clear he wants something. My father was very embarrassed at this point. He said he didn't know how to tell his father that his son wanted a piece of bread on Yom Kippur, so he finally told my grandfather I want a piece of bread. He doesn't understand. It's a gift. My grandfather said, well, why don't you get it for him? So I guess I was a brat even then.
No, you were just a hungry little boy. How long did you stay in Lithuania? Do you remember?
I don't remember how long it was. Mm-hmm. It seemed interminable to me, but I'm sure it was a very short time. I remember, the other thing I remember is that I guess I must have been more than five because I was reading. And I had a Babar the Elephant book in French. Babar l'Elephant.
Yeah.
And I remember being in Berlin, and I remember we had to go from one railroad station to another in Berlin, and we had to cross a street. We had to walk for some reason, and there was a large parade. It turned out I may have seen Amalek himself.
Mm-hmm. This was what year?
This must have been 1937.
37 or 38. Could have been some native fascists.
No, this was in Berlin.
Oh, in Berlin.
So I believe that Adolf himself was passing by.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently I again made quite a fuss about crossing the street, and my father was kind of terrified. You know, here we were Jewish, making a fuss. And apparently the policeman just saw this little boy making a fuss, and he stopped the parade and waved us across, just get out of here. So I guess my desire to have my own way go back a long way in that sense. I remember my grandfather had a long white beard, and my grandmother was a sickly woman. I don't remember much else.
Was your grandfather affectionate toward you?
I don't remember. I suspect he was.
Mm-hmm.
I remember being hugged and so forth. I remember not liking it. And I remember there being a lot of people. There was aunt, there were second cousins and aunts and uncles. I had an aunt, Scylla, who was a dentist, and I remember being absolutely fascinated by her office because, I remember this to my dying day, I guess, she had a little alcohol lamp which was lit, and I thought this was the most marvelous thing I'd ever seen in my life.
Magical.
Magical.
Yes. Were your folks observant, Dr. Lepetz?
Please call me Jean.
Yeah.
Well, yes and no. Both my parents had come from observant families.
Mm-hmm.
As I remember, we did keep kosher at home. And when I was sent to school, I went to a private school called Bachkanoni in Antwerp. And I wasn't told about how this happened, but all I remember is, you know, that in the morning, I was told I was going to school, and I was very excited, and went to the school, and the teacher, you know, put us in our seats and so forth. I was, I guess, seven. And the teacher said to us in French, j'ai oublié tout mon français, je parle seulement l'hébreu maintenant. I forgot all of my French, and we are only going to speak Hebrew from now on, and
mm-hmm.
he did.
Mm-hmm.
And by golly, it worked. By the end of the first couple of months, we were speaking to each other, and I was able to converse with my father in Hebrew.
Amazing. May I hear again the name of the school?
Tachtemoni. T-A-K-H-E-M-O-N-I. It's the name of a very famous medieval poem. And I forget the author of it, but I've seen it listed in a number of anthologies.
Thank you.
And
did you like the school?
I loved it.
You did?
I became an ardent Zionist within 1 week and wanted to take off right away. I asked my father why we couldn't get there. My father and I used to go for walks occasionally along the docks in Antwerp. I remember asking why couldn't we just get on one of those boats and go to Palestine.
You sang Hebrew songs?
We sang Hebrew songs, we learned Chumash, and then we learned to read and write Hebrew. And in the afternoon, we did the same thing in French. So I learned to read and write from left to right and right to left at the same time, and it worked.
No confusion?
Yes, there was. I can remember one summer trying to write a letter to a friend in French, and trying to write the French from right to left. And it doesn't work.
It doesn't work.
It doesn't work, and I remember being very frustrated by this. But I had, my father had, I don't know what happened to these notes, this stuff was, of course, lost. I wrote letters. My father would come on business occasionally, various parts of Belgium, France, and I would write him letters. And, you know, those days were before airplanes where people could come and go several hundred miles in one day. And I wrote him letters in Hebrew without dots, and I've seen them since. for the life of me, I have a hard time figuring them out.
Well, but I guess if you spent more time and more intensively with the material,
I'm sure a lot of it would come back.
Yeah.
Although I'm amazed how much has come back over the last few years.
May I ask how long you were at this school?
Just two years, because then the war broke out.
Was there any conflict between your associations with Jewish children? I suppose this was an all-Jewish school.
It was an all-Jewish school.
Any conflict insofar as your friendships with non-Jewish children might have overlapped?
I don't think I knew any non-Jewish children.
Uh-huh. Did you live in an all-Jewish neighborhood?
No, the neighborhood was not all Jewish by any means.
Mm-hmm.
I know the people next door were the Goyim.
But you didn't have any non-Jewish friends?
I had no. The only conflict I can remember, and it's only a conflict in retrospect, is my parents had a series of governesses for us kids. And one of them was an ex-nun or had been or wanted to be a nun or something, and was apparently trying to teach me all kinds of non-Jewish, mostly superstitions, dogmas, what have you. My parents found out about this, mainly because I got very scared.
I can imagine.
Something about devils taking me or something like that, and my parents found out, they fired her immediately. That's all I can remember. I remember going to synagogue, and I don't remember which one. Jed has a book of synagogues, and there were four in Antwerp, and I don't recognize which one it was for sure. I remember going, and what I remember in 10th grade, I think so, but I'm not sure.
You were what, seven?
Yeah, I remember, seven, eight. I remember wearing a talit katan all the time.
Mm-hmm.
I took it very seriously.
Mm-hmm.
And I can remember one of my parents' friends, Mr. Bagon, had gone to Palestine and come back on business of some sort, and he had brought us all back kippahs from Jerusalem. They were hand-embroidered and said Jerusalem. And I think that was one of the last things I lost in the course of our escape. I had that for years and years and years. I think it either got so worn out that it needed a decent burial or fell apart. I don't remember.
You had said you were an ardent Zionist as a youngster. Did your parents share that fervor?
I think my father did. I'm not so sure about my mother.
But they weren't thinking it all seriously
of emigrating? No, not that I know of. If they were, they didn't.
Did they ever talk to you about any anti-Semitism they had encountered in Antwerp? Or would you have been aware?
I was not aware of any, and I don't know.
They seemed happy.
There was a very large Jewish community there, which had been established for some time.
Mm-hmm.
I think the Jewish community, in Belgium, dates back to, I think, the 13th century or earlier, but the modern Antwerp community dates back to the independence of Belgium, which was in 1831 or 32.
Mm-hmm.
And I was also a very ardent Belgian,
loyal and supportive.
I used to occasionally get I remember 1 franc from my mother, and I could buy a chocolate bar. The chocolate bar I liked best was Chocolat Jacques. I liked it because A, was good chocolate, but B, it had my name on it, so it was very special. And in this wrapper, there was a picture, there would be a series of pictures of the royal family. And if you collected enough pictures and wrappers, you could send in the wrappers, and it would send you an album. And I was working on my third album of photographs of the royal family. So I was, a very loyal little Belgian boy, and I watched parades where the king would come by and things like that.
From what I have learned of survivors and what I know about the history of Jews in Belgium, the experience was generally a very benign one. And Jews, as you say, like their life. Were you aware as a child of anything ominous happening before the invasion? Did your parents indicate any apprehension when they had had?
Yeah, they did.
They did.
There's one funny incident. which is not direct, it is related, but indirectly, that apparently just before the Russians invaded Poland, there had been some war talk and about the bombing of Warsaw and so forth. I had some hunch that something terrible was happening in some very far away place. Mm-hmm. And apparently one morning, I would go downstairs in the morning and bring in a newspaper which was delivered. And I would then bring the newspaper up to my father. And I came in screaming one morning. I was not going to school and they weren't going to get me out of the house. And no matter, no way, I mean, this was it.
Why didn't you want me to school?
Because the headline on the newspaper said, "L'ours est déchaîné," which means, which translated is, the USSR is unleashed, that is when Russia is there. But l'ours also means, it's spelled differently, the bear. So I was convinced I was a loose bear in town, and no way was I going to tangle with the thing.
How did your parents?
They laughed. They thought they finally showed me that Ours de l'Union République Soviétique Socialiste. I remember being absolutely sure I was not going to go out and get mauled by a bear. I mean, no way was that going to happen to me.
Was there any discussion in school as far as you can remember?
Not that I can remember. There was
Nazi men.
No, there was a lot of discussion about Aliyah and about going to Tel Aviv and building the port and unloading. I can remember not wanting to go to gym and my Hebrew teacher saying to me, you know, if you are going to go to unload the boats at the dock, you better go to gym and be big and strong, because what we need there are people who are going to be big and strong. And so I went to gym. I haven't liked gym ever since either, but it worked out a little boy.
Were you aware of some Jews going to Palestine at the time?
Only this man I mentioned before, Mr.
Yes.
Begon, on business. I didn't know of anybody making aliyah.
Or families going elsewhere?
No.
To Italy, possibly? Or
no.
France?
No.
No.
The community, the part of the community I was with was very cohesive, and they all stayed there.
They all stayed.
The first sign I realized that there was something wrong was in 1940,
mm-hmm.
when my father had, in previous summers, had every summer as far back as I can remember, rented a summer place where we would spend the summer.
In Belgium?
In Belgium.
Mm-hmm.
And we usually went to one of two or three places, Heide, Nocke, and Zitte, which were, Heide was in the country, and Nocke and Zitte are on the seashore. And this time he rented a villa in a place called La Panne, which is on the Belgian side of the border of Dunkirk.
Mm-hmm.
And he also took us out of school, took me out of school, my brothers were too young, a month or two early. And, you know, I said, why can't I finish school? I enjoyed school, I really wanted to go. Mm-hmm. We're gonna have an end of school year exercise, and I was missing. I was really very angry. And my father explained that he thought there might be a war, and that the Belgians would hold out. In World War I, the Belgians had held a salient in that area with King Albert,
mm-hmm.
who was king of the Belgians at the time. And my father, I guess, really believed that somehow the Belgian army would hold back the Nazis and we would be safe. And I can remember, you know, we lived in this villa, and my father had bought 100 kilo bags of potatoes and things like that. We were going to stay there.
The whole family was,
yes,
there.
And,
it's L-E-P-A-N?
No, L-A, capital P-A-N-N-E.
Oh.
Which became sort of a joke, because pantin means, this is French slang for broken down. My voiture est en panne, and my car had a breakdown.
Mm-hmm.
So there were all kinds of puns. And that's when I began to realize that there was something wrong, that things weren't quite right. Although we did go back to Antwerp for the commencement, but the exercises,
closing
exercise, and I remember being, I was not on the stage because I hadn't been in school. I was really an angry little boy about that.
Yeah.
I felt that I'd been cheated.
Mm. How long did you stay in the city when you returned from?
Just for a day or two.
Oh, and then you went back to
Went back to La Panne.
Were there many Jews, as far as you knew?
In La Panne, I don't remember.
Mm-hmm. What did you do there? How did you occupy yourself?
Well, you know, I, was a little boy, we'd go to the beach and play in the beach and play in the sand and make mud pies, I guess, and things like that. And I read. I was always an avid reader. Mm-hmm. I would read anything and everything I could get my hands on. It didn't matter what it was. It was a good word. I would read.
Any trouble spending your time?
I don't remember having any problems mm-hmm. with that.
And was father able to maintain his work?
Father stayed. Father stayed in Antwerp and would come in for weekends.
I see.
So mm-hmm.
And that went on for?
That went on, I would say, for about 2 months.
Mm-hmm.
And then on May, the weekend of May 10th, 1940, and I don't remember what day of the week it was, I could easily find out. My mother went to Antwerp to spend the weekend with my father. Instead of him coming up, she went in mm-hmm. and they spent the weekend together. And that was the day that the war broke out. And I can remember this, being in the house and hearing all kinds of terrible noises.
You were still in La Panne?
I was in La Panne with my brothers and governess.
Mm-hmm.
And hearing all kinds of terrible, scary noises, seeing flashes of light and sirens and waking up and asking the governess, who we refer was always known as Mademoiselle, what was going on, and she knew what was going on, but she didn't want to frighten us.
Mm-hmm.
And she said I knew that the French were at war with the Germans,
mm-hmm.
That there was a French ship that had been hit by shells or something, and that they were making signals for some kind of cock and bull story, she said. And I sort of believed it, but I could tell that there's something which I've since labeled the smell of fear. You can feel it, and I could tell there was something very, very wrong. It wasn't just...
Were you worried about your parents?
I worried. I don't remember, but I can remember that, my governess was, Mademoiselle was very good, and she was a very nice person, as I remember her. She was, we used to go for walks together and have long philosophical discussions about religion,
really?
Even though she was Catholic, and she was very good. She was, taught me a lot of things about the world around us and things like that. She was, anyhow, she may also have been an ex-nun. There's been a number of them in my life. I know that when my parents finally got, what had normally been a 2-hour or 3-hour trip took like a whole day to get out of Antwerp. I remember my mother hysterically holding us. Then I found out that the war had been declared, and of course, I believed what my father said. I believed that, the Belgian army, I had two cousins who were in the army, and I remember, how brave and strong they looked, and they would come in for a weekend, and I would help them pull off their knee-high boots, and I could polish their boots for them. This was really great for the Belgian army. The Belgians are going to hold out, and we'll show those Nazis a thing or two.
Mm.
Well, I guess we didn't.
When did your parents return to La Panne?
It must have been May 11th.
They came back very quickly.
It was that day.
Yes.
Okay, May 10th, or maybe early in the morning on the 11th.
And then
they somehow made it back. From there on in, I think within a day or so, it became very clear to my father and to anybody else who cared to look that the Belgians were not going to hold out, and that the brave Belgian army was not going to hold back the Blitzkrieg, and that we were in for a lot of trouble, and we elected to leave.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember packing up and getting on a train, and we were going to go to France. And apparently, I was told later that my father's family was in the United States. His two older brothers were in the United States, and he had a sister in the United Kingdom.
Mm-hmm.
So with all my mother's family, we were going to meet. There was a plan, a contingency plan had been made that we would meet somewhere in France. Mm-hmm. I forget where the place was mm-hmm. supposed to be, where we would all try to get to in case of war.
I see.
And it's odd because that I did not learn that until I was an adult, because in 1952, 1952, there was one of the perennial crises between the United States and the Soviet Union. My father, I was at college at the time in Providence, and my father wrote me a letter saying that if anything happens, here is an address. He was in California. Mm-hmm. Try and get there. This is what we're going to make.
Still conditioned to think about a retreat.
Right. Yeah. As far away as possible. So I can remember that.
Did you get to France then?
Yeah, we got to France by train. And I remember this was a horrendous train trip. There were stops. And we were in this, you know, French trains have these compartments. And in this compartment was a man who came in with a limp and claimed he had a wooden leg. He had been hurt in World War One or something. And my younger brother kept bumping into him, and he was got more upset over this little kid than he should have been. And my parents were a little suspicious. To make a long story of the tale, which I don't remember, sure, he was a German spy. He was caught, taken out, and shot.
On the train?
He wasn't shot on the train.
I mean, taken
out. He was
taken
off the train, and they caught him. And he apparently had a radio transmitter in his
wooden
leg. So then I realized that, you know, this was not a child's game. Things were pretty serious. And
how long did the trip take, do you think, actually?
Days. I remember being in Lyon, which is still north of Paris. And I think we met in Paris. I seem to remember meeting about this in Paris. I remember being in Paris. I also have very vivid memories of having diarrhea through the entire trip, which I'm sure was anxiety. And everybody feeling sick and food being one thing. You know, the funny little detail that come back, but somewhere we had bartered for some food in France, and we'd gotten some bread and butter, and the French used salted butter, and in my home we'd only had unsalted butter. And when I tasted it, I remember making a face or something and being told, "Be glad that you have something to eat." I don't remember much. I remember being in Paris. I remember we seeing the Eiffel Tower. I remember being taken to a physician for some reason. I don't know what. And the reason I remember that is because he was a real old-fashioned physician. He didn't listen to my chest with a stethoscope, but he put a handkerchief over my chest and put his ear on the handkerchief and listened directly.
Excuse me.
Pause. It was in Paris.
Paris, yes.
And then we had, somewhere around Paris, we had teamed up with, with my uncle Jack and his wife Bertha and their two children, Rachel and Caroline, and with my Aunt Rosa and her husband David and his two children, Benny and my cousin Jack, who was about 2 years older. He was always known as Le Grand Jackie, the large or the big Jack, and I was the petit Jackie. And I sort of worshipped the ground he walked on and hit at him at the same time. it was an interesting relationship. We teamed up, and they had cars, little Minervas, I think, which were Belgian-made cars.
They wanted to get out.
They had gotten out. Yeah, we did. We had met. This was, I think, we'd met somewhere outside of Paris, as I remember. But I'm not clear on exactly where it was that we sort of hooked up.
They were already leaving.
And there was also my Aunt Malvin, who was my mother's youngest sister, who was pregnant and whose husband was in the Belgian army, and we didn't know where he was. He was alive or what. And there may have been a few other people in that group. And we went in this caravan of two or three cars through France. And one place I remember we stayed at for a short while was a place called Saint-Palais-sur-Mer, where we had rented this very large, it was obviously on the sea, very large villa, and we stayed there for a while. And when it looked like the French might hold up, when it's clear the French wouldn't hold up. I remember the day that Belgium capitulated, that the week before, Life magazine had a cover story, a cover photograph of the King of the Belgians, Leopold III. And this picture was proudly hung in the room we all, the communal dining room we had.
How long did you stay there? I don't remember.
It couldn't have been very long. And
the adults seemed apprehensive.
Yes. Well, when Belgium capitulated, I remember his picture was ripped off and torn apart, and the sale cochon had given up, which turns out, of course, was the only thing he really could do.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I also remember being in a small town in France, and my two brothers were quite sick, and we didn't know what was wrong. And so we looked for the doctor, and it turns out that this was after the capitulation of Belgium. The doctor, the physician in town, was also the mayor.
Mm-hmm.
And he found we were Belgians, we had two sick kids, and he said, as mayor, I cannot come to you traitorous Belgians. But after 5 o'clock, I'm not the mayor anymore.
Yes.
The doctor.
Mm-hmm.
So he did come, and to add insult to injury, what do you suppose my brothers had? Nothing better than German measles. Which was just a wonderful disease to have.
They were tots.
Yeah, they were tots. Let's see. I was 8, I guess.
Take one, side two, continuing our interview with Dr. Lepet. Leon was 5.
Leon was 5, and Eric must have been 3.5.
Mm-hmm.
So we kept going. I remember going through towns whose names at that time I thought were kind of pointed, existing, like Bergerac and Archerac and
mm-hmm.
places like that.
You were still in the 2 or 3 cars.
Right.
And all of the relatives were still intact.
So far. Somewhere on that trip, a decision was made mm-hmm. that my cousin Benny, who is Jack's older brother, David and Rose's son, would try to leave us and go to England.
Mm-hmm.
Because they were afraid that he was, I guess, just 17 or 18. And the fear was if he were caught, he'd be forced into an army, one side or another, what have you.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember the tremendous
trauma
of his leaving and the fear he would never see him again. Then I realized then that things were really terribly wrong.
That somehow the world I knew was the one I had been promised.
Anyway, he left for Belgium amid much crying and wailing. You know, will we ever see him again? And I remember the other thing I remember from this was a tremendous contagion of hysteria, because, you know, his mother got hysterical, and of course everybody followed, including his kids, and we didn't really know. I remember not knowing why we were crying and why we were upset completely, but, you know, people went to England all the time. It was a big deal. Mm-hmm. It was clear that he might never get that far.
He was planning to join...
No, he was planning on getting to England and seeing what would happen.
But There must have been some plan.
He did make it. He spent the war years in England, and he came back to the States afterwards.
And how many of the group then were left still in France? Still a large party.
There was still a large party.
And did the illness of your brother hold the group up?
No, he kept on going.
He kept on going.
There was no choice. The Germans were too close behind.
And you were going in which direction?
We were going south towards Marseille. The plan, as I understand it, was to go to Marseille, and that we were hoping that my uncle Jack, who was in the Belgian army, and his brother Emmanuel, or Mon, who also was in the army, would come and we would all meet somehow in Marseille. And every day, when we finally got to Marseille, we rented this large villa where all the family stayed. And every day people went, I remember, to the Canavière, which was the, kind of like the boardwalk, I guess, in Marseille, and looking for news, you know, the women, people were talking and reading and trying to figure out. And it was in Marseille that I first, you know, got some first-hand lessons about prejudice and I think there was some anti-Semitism around being more anti-Belgian.
I see.
I remember being poked fun of. I went to school there because we speak French slightly differently in Belgium. We don't say, you know, for the number 70, we say septante, and for the number 90, we say nanant. In France, it's soixante, which is 60 and 10, and 90 becomes 90, and I could never understand why they had suddenly do this crazy thing.
And that kind of differentiated?
That differentiated me from the other children. And I remember being poked. I don't remember whether it was specifically. Well, there were some anti. I seem to remember somebody saying Salut in a 32. I remember being made aware of the fact that I was a refugee and that I was different and that things were very difficult.
How was the teacher?
I don't remember. I remember having a very hard time in school, not liking it, not wanting to go.
Were you with any of your cousins?
My cousin went to school with me. He was a grade or two.
We walked to school.
It was a pretty long walk.
And do you know what? How father was able to manage economically?
No idea.
Use up his savings.
No idea. All I know is that there was all kinds of different kinds of money around. American dollars, French francs, Belgian francs, Swiss francs, you name it. There were also some jewels and some gold or platinum bars. I don't remember any precious metal. I don't know how we survived. I remember that it was very hard. I remember Marseille being the real Marseille in August. It was very hot.
Were you ever hungry?
I don't remember being hungry, but I do remember... What is it? Somewhere in the flight, we had stopped the car to get food or water or gas. Or, I don't know. We stopped in a small town for a while. We were in this. I remember it as a parking lot. I don't know if there were parking lots in those days, but whatever it was, there were other cars there. And I remember there being a crust of bread on the ground. And a little boy, I started playing soccer with it, football we called it. And my cousin of Rachel saying, telling me not to do this because someday I would not have this.
Mm.
And she was right.
Mm. But to this day,
you can't waste bread.
I find it very difficult to throw out bread, even if it's moldy.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing I remember from that is looking at other cards with my cousin, and I remember seeing one card that was absolutely marvelous. And I asked him what kind of he found was Ken. It was an Oldsmobile.
Thank you.
And it's odd that today I own an Oldsmobile.
Was it the bigness? The luxury?
The luxury. I seem to remember it being absolutely beautiful. And it was also American. Everything American was very romantic.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea was we were in Marseille. And the idea was we were going to apply for transit visas through Spain to Portugal, and from Lisbon take a boat to the United States. And I didn't remember, I didn't know all the details, other than that it was very difficult. And you had to apply here, and you had to apply there. And there were these mysterious papers called affidavits, which I had no idea what they were, but they were clearly very, very important.
Do you remember the word?
I remember the word because I thought it had something to do with my Uncle David. It was an affidavit.
Oh.
It had nothing to do with him, but it wasn't clear what it was. I also thought that davening was named after him because he was very religious, and I thought that because David davened every day that it was named after him. I learned differently since. Maybe rest in peace. And I can remember, you know, things being real tough, and we had this large, each family had a room, then we had a, we used a kitchen communally, and we ate communally. I remember at one point, I don't know what had happened, but some particularly bad piece of news had come through, and my Aunt Rosa throwing her arms up in the air and shrieking out, Russell Zynerberg. And,
you knew what that meant.
I understood Yiddish because my parents didn't want us to, so obviously I picked it up very fast. And I remember absolute hysteria. Nobody could calm anybody else down. It was, you know, the kids, all of us. It was, you know, one of the most horrifying things
I can remember. 42, I wonder.
This was already 42.
Could have been
early 42, late 41, early 42.
Early 42.
Now wait a minute.
If it was late.
It was 41 still.
41.
The war broke out in 1940 in Belgium. And America didn't get into the war December 42.
Could have been the invasion of Russia.
I don't know what it was. It could have been. But I'm not. No, that happened. We were already in the Philippines. So I don't know. I think it was just
some
absolute panic.
War news, maybe.
I don't know what it was, but it was a horrible thing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, finally, what happened was it became clear that we could get to Lisbon. We could get passage because, as I said, my father had two brothers in this country, and my mother had a brother who was in this country. He had married an American wife, and he, if this was going back, before the whole mess started, I could live my Uncle Sam and Aunt Dora, and they had two little girls, leaving Belgium and going back to the States, because my Aunt Dora was born in America, and she was an American citizen, and the very Americans were told to get out.
Mm-hmm.
So she left, and I wanted to know why were they going to the United States, and what was wrong with being here, and so forth. Well, they went to the States.
Mm-hmm.
So we had the proper affidavits, I guess, or whatever it took to get to the States. The problem was to get to Lisbon.
Mm-hmm.
Now, at that time, we were in so-called Vichy France. And, you know, apparently the French, the Britannic government had not become verbally anti-Semitic yet, but then, as far as I know, there were no problems, no obvious problems. The problem that the hang-up came that my father would not be given a transit visa to Spain because Franco's government had declared
that no men under 40 years of age, above 17, between 17 and 40, could pass these things because they were afraid they would go to join the British in Gibraltar. That chances. My father, when he rest in peace, joined business to Gibraltar, but it was probably some sprouting wind. This was the official excuse. So mother and my two brothers and I took a train from Marseille and made very careful goodbyes, wondering whether we'd ever see these people again. And we packed enough food to last us 5 days, because we thought this food would be very scarce, if available at all in Spain. And we went through the crossing point at a place called Port-Boue. P-O-R-T-B-O-U-E, which literally means port of mud. And I can remember we went through Spanish customs. We were taken aside and we were interviewed by this woman for some reason. And there was a huge portrait of Franco on the wall. I looked at him, a little breath came out of him, and I said, "Quel dit le roi des Espagnols? Is he the king of Spain?" And the woman was furious. "You should teach your child that you do not have a thing here. We have a..." Whatever. My mother was simply picking out in shock at this point. How would I know? I mean, he was obviously... It was bad enough the French didn't have a king, but I was, at least the Spaniards could have a king. We made it through Spain, mostly on, I guess he called it in this country, gingerbread, pain de peace. And whatever we could... Yeah, we spent one night in Barcelona and one night in Madrid, and I remember being shocked by the utter poverty and dirt. It was pathetic. Although we were treated nicely, it was pathetic. I mean, I could see even as a child the poverty and they had just recovered from the Civil War, which was over a year or two ago, burned out buildings and things like that. And it was probably shorter. I mean, I can't imagine taking 5 days to cross Spain by train, but it seemed like it was 5 years or something going through Spain, but not knowing the language and, you know, my mother had never traveled with the two kids alone, with three small children, not knowing whether we'd ever see anybody else again. And we got to the border to Portugal, and there was, of course, the fear, you know, that the Portuguese might change their minds, or the Spaniards might change. We finally got to Lisbon, and stayed at a pension. My mother, my two brothers, and I, we stayed at a boarding house, waiting for my father to come and join us, and we would then take a boat to America. Again, you know, there was a large community of Belgians and other Europeans who had fled to Lisbon. Every day there was a promenade along the port, along the Tagus River, and we're walking there and meeting other people and talking and asking, do you know anything? Okay. Have you heard from so-and-so? And you know, and people were telling little carnets, little books with names and addresses, and wondering and going to the post office every day, because the only way you could get mail was through what they call in Europe poste restante. There was a system in the city where you could write to somebody care of such and such a post office, and you know, you'd come and ask if there was mail from the poste restante, and it just being a big thing.
Did mother hear from father that
Well, day? Let me tell you, that's an interesting story. Finally, my father decided the only way he was going to get through, there was no point petitioning the Spanish authorities, was to go to Morocco, and from Morocco go to Lisbon, and there apparently was a boat going from Tangiers to Lisbon. So somehow my father got boat passage from Marseille to Morocco, which was not terribly difficult, and he got to Morocco, and he asked for a Portuguese visa, which they gave him, and he tried to book on this boat. And he kept going, and the boat was postponed, finally, and he went to the Portuguese consul, and the Portuguese consul said, "Look, Mr. Lippitt, I'm going to have to tell you that there is no such boat, and there never will be one again." And I said, "What am I going to do?" And he explained the story, and my father, to his dying day, believed this man may have been a Marano.
He knew your father was Jewish.
So he told my father, he said, "You know, I can't do anything for you, but, you know, God forbid anything happened to your kids. very sick or something, I'd have to, as an act of mercy, give you a visa on an airplane, take a plane that way. Mm-hmm. So my father understood what he meant, and he wrote to my mother, said, saying, send a telegram saying, kids are desperately sick, we need you.
Mm-hmm.
My mother was a very superstitious woman, she wouldn't do it.
My dear.
She was afraid that if you say something like that, all of it should happen, that she would, to her dying day, whenever any of us got sick, fortunately, nobody got seriously sick, she was always afraid it was just a curse coming back.
Yeah.
She was a simple woman that way.
So she wouldn't send her to you.
Finally, my father had to, kept writing her stronger and stronger letters. Finally, I think he said, but he said, do it if you ever want to see me again. So she goes, she said that was one of the hardest things she ever had to do in her life.
Mm-hmm.
And she sent the telegram, and sure enough, 2 days later, the plane, we got a telegram saying, arriving on flight, whatever it was in those days.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember being very jealous because my father was flying on an airplane. Mm-hmm. That was a real neat thing. As a kid.
Sure.
And I remember he came, and I almost didn't recognize him because he'd grown a mustache. And asked him about Morocco and so forth. And we were in Lisbon for, I guess, a fairly short time. Because in January 41, we embarked on the SS Siboney.
Oh, that's so.
S-I-B-O-N-E-Y. Which was a tiny tub which used to travel between Florida and Cuba. And had been pressed. At that time, the Americans were sending everything they could over, or supposedly, I don't know, after reading the abandonment of the Jews and so forth, I wonder what was going on. But anyway, we got on this leaky tub.
This was not for the Atlantic.
For the Atlantic. And we crossed the Atlantic in the worst January on record to that time. We've been reported sunk twice. I was seasick from the time we left the mouth of the Tagus River to the time we were stopped in Bermuda by the British and searched by the British Navy.
How many people were on board?
I have no idea. All I know is I was sick. I was so sick.
Mm-hmm.
I thought I was, that was it. I just, why were they doing this to me? And my brothers were sick, and my mother was sick. And the one thing I remember, the one thing my mother could eat, odd again, was cream cheese. But not just any cream cheese. It had to be Philadelphia.
Oh, my word.
And,
that's just really...
That was when I first heard the name Philadelphia. Here I am living here. It's sort of interesting coincidence, I guess.
Do you have any idea how long this took?
I think the boat trip was 9 or 11 days. Mm-hmm. And it took a long time. It was a small boat. It's not made for January crossing.
Mm.
And I remember we landed in New York. I remember seeing the Statue of Liberty. And we landed in New York, I guess it was in early February 1941. And we stayed with various uncles. And I thought we were, then it became very clear we were not going to stay there. We were not allowed to stay. Because our quota number had not come up. And my father, being a law-abiding citizen, decided he would go to the Philippines where my uncle had a business.
Mm-hmm.
He had a business there for many years. And we stayed in the States for 1 month.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember meeting my American relative for the first time. I had my uncle Elijah and Aunt Ruth, and they rest in peace, and a cousin Esther, who unfortunately got killed in an auto accident sometime later, and two cousins, Leo and Manami, who I thought was just marvelous. I mean, they went to the Bronx High School of Science.
Mm-hmm.
They were very bright. And we lived, they stayed at the Amalgamated Clothing Workers Department complex in the Bronx. It's still standing there on Jackson Avenue. So I think it's changing, but it was ethnically very Jewish at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a wonderful place this was, and wonderful America was. And everybody in New York was Jewish, because we drove upstairs in the park, and my uncle would meet various people and talk Yiddish to them, or Russian.
Mm-hmm.
And I figured, well, we must have met everybody in New York at this point. 9 years old, and everybody spoke Yiddish, so everybody must have been Jewish. And it didn't occur to me that they might not be. Anyway, we left. And the book package, I guess it was at the end of March, on a Norwegian steamer, the Ivernt, I-V-A-R-A-N-T, parents, my two brothers and I, and we sailed from New York through the Panama Canal, which is very exciting, and then up to San Diego and Los Angeles, where we met another Lippitz who came down from Vancouver in San Francisco. He was there. He's still alive. He met my cousin Joe, my father's cousin, Joseph Lippitz, who was in the salmon fishing business in Vancouver, British Columbia. And then we set sail from San Francisco for the Philippines in a Norwegian flag ship, which was it was not a passenger ship, it was one of those steamers that has, you know, a few cabins. But there were a few other passengers, I don't remember them, across the Pacific, with dire warning that, you know, we were for the fair game from Japanese or German, no, not Japanese, German submarine.
German
submarine. This was the one thing I remember. Anyway, we had a Pacific crossing, remember, not being sick. And my father explained, you know, that this is called the Pacific Ocean, and Pacific means calm, and you're not going to get sick, and don't worry about it. And he was right, whether it really was a calm crossing, whether he convinced me another way that, you know, but I remember the trip as being relatively uneventful, except for the one time that the captain had a swimming pool constructed on deck. About one of these, he put some crates together and put some tarps and stuff over the water. He said, "You're all going to learn how to swim. If we get torpedoes, you need to know how to swim." And I wasn't about to learn. I was scared to death. So the captain was a big man. I don't know if he was, but he was a big man. And he grabbed me, put a life belt, a life jacket around me, and threw me into the water and said, "You're going to learn how to swim." And I guess he was right. I was terrified. I was terrified. I hated it. And I remember hitting him with my little fist, and he was laughing at me. He thought it was great. I don't remember his name, but he was a very nice man.
You learned to swim?
I learned to I learned to stay afloat. To this day, I cannot dive into water. If I go in, I go in on my own power. So we landed in Manila. I guess it was May or June 41. And my father, we found an apartment after a little while, and we stayed there, and I started going to school, where my brothers and I went to a school, and my youngest brother, Eric, came back and said he could understand the song we sang in the morning. So he sang it, and he was saying, "Good morning to you, good morning to you. We greet you with bright Chinese faces." I remember struggling with English, that it was, I realized it was an impossible language, that there was no way I would ever learn it.
I still feel that way.
It was English. It had been an American colony long enough that English was a major language. Then my aunt and uncle left, and my mother was furious that they had left us here. We were in this horrible place. It was very hot. My mother had a very hard time. The tropics are difficult to live in.
These are the people.
Not as bad as Philadelphia in the summer. Really not as bad. These were people who owned
businesses. Where did they go to?
Back in the States. But my uncle was. Went back and forth, you know, once a year, twice a year, whatever it was. He was one of the first people to take the China Clipper across. That's when he took 4 days to fly across the Pacific.
You're a pioneer.
And so this was about May 41. And in December 41, the Japanese declared war. And very shortly thereafter, we were under Japanese occupation. Manila was declared an open city, and there was no fighting. One day the Japanese were there, and that was that.
How did your life change?
Well, first of all, there were soldiers in the streets with guns, who were very nice to children, but they were kind of brutal to each other as well as to other people. I mean, it was in the Japanese army, a non-commissioned officers had to be saluted by privates and so forth. Tell me, didn't salute somebody else properly, you'd get beaten up for it. And we were not put into, we were sent to Tomas in German camp for a short while. We were released because we were Belgian subjects, and technically not war with Japan.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember we were released before my father. My father had stepped in longer for some reason. My mother went to visit him. And when you passed by, we kept many sentries in various places, and obviously around the concentration, when you passed by a sentry, there was a certain protocol as to how deep you had to bow and for how long you had to maintain your bow while passing. And my mother did not bow deep enough or long enough or something, mm-hmm. and the Japanese sentry just slapped her across the face.
Mm-hmm.
And there were incidents like that. By and large, certainly towards the beginning of the war, the Japanese were not unfriendly. I can even remember that the Japanese commander or assistant, he was a big shot, Colonel Kodaki, was instrumental in helping us get out of the concentration camp, and my parents invited him to lunch or to tea or something. We were meeting him.
How long were you in the camp?
Not very long.
Few weeks.
And
you were with mother
and
in,
father and
in the same
right.
and place.
Yeah. But I remember of it. Some of that is very vague.
Yeah, but you don't
vague.
Remember any particularly cruel
treatment. No, I don't.
Mm-hmm.
I do remember cruel treatment later.
Later.
Not at this point, no.
And when you were released, you went back to the
apartment. And so that kind of brutality was you saw, but it was not a brutality aimed at anybody, it was just their way of life, their code of ethics.
Mm-hmm.
I remember though in the apartment house next door, they caught a young Filipino young man stealing, and they took the man, and they tied him up to a telephone pole, and in public view, without a trial, he beat him to death.
Mm-hmm.
I literally saw a person. Mm-hmm. I saw a person beaten until he was dead. And that was their idea. He was caught red-handed. There's no need for a trial, and the punishment for stealing from military was death. And he was going to beat him to death. That's a pretty horrible thing.
Did father work?
Father had a business with animal hair, and exactly what he did or how he did it is very mysterious, and he never would talk about it.
Mm-hmm. But he managed to earn a living?
He managed to earn a living, I don't know how. And he would never talk.
Mm-hmm.
Even afterwards, my brother would ask him. He was always very vague about how he did it.
Some things are private.
Some things are private. And after the Japanese took over, after the Japanese took over, I started, maybe just before. Yeah, before they took over, I discovered that there was, a synagogue in Manila. And we were enrolled in Jewish school and Sunday school and
mm-hmm.
all the good things there. And I was shocked to find out that they didn't do things in Hebrew there. I didn't think it was Hebrew because they were all German Jews. And they were Ashkenaz, and I had learned Spartan.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't understand what they were talking about. They couldn't pronounce their brachas properly. And they also, for some reason, I never learned how to write Hebrew in lower case. All they could do, they would do it in capital letters.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember being shocked by this.
Mm-hmm.
Because by that time, I'd had 2 years of Hebrew. And it was very intense,
no.
half the day.
Very fresh.
It was still very fresh for me. And there was a rabbi, and it was almost 80 to 90% German Jews. They were more German than they were Jewish.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they kept telling how wonderful Germany was. They would go around with all my friends, and they would all talk German. And the rabbi would give their sermons in German. How that stuck in their craw, I don't know. But he was very German, and